Welcome to Live City Line Reel on Race. We are about to get into a discussion about all Black Lives Matter. It's a topic I've been wanting to speak about since the very beginning. First of all, let me introduce you to our lovely panel today. Luca Rosenberg-Lee is a brand consultant and filmmaker who identifies as a trans man. Welcome, Luca. Cicely Bell-Blaine is back. Welcome back, Cicely. A diversity consultant, Black Lives Matter Vancouver co-founder, and queer woman. We're happy to have you back. Raven Wings, the Black Widow of Burlesque, is a movement storyteller, artist, and woman of Afro-Indigenous trans experience. She is also a steering committee member of Black Lives Matter Toronto. I know all three of you have been incredibly busy, so I appreciate you all making the time to chat with us today about this very important subject. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I was reminded by my colleague, Jody Glean Mitchell, last week, and my Rogers colleague, Nicole McCormick, that we're visitors in this space. Well, Nicole isn't, but I am. So I want to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabeg, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee and the Wendat peoples, and is now home to many diverse First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples. I don't take that for granted. So I'm going to get to the first question. Is there evidence Black women, Black trans people, and Black folks who are queer identifying are being left out of the recent racial uprising that we have seen around the world? And if so, why do you think that is? Luca, I'm going to start with you.
Really good question. I mean, I think that there's evidence that it's happening as well as that it's not happening. I know for myself, I guess as a trans person, I can say while this has all been going on, which is not new, these conversations around Black Lives Matter and racism, I do find that my identity, I guess, as a trans person kind of takes more hold of how I feel about myself and my safety and all the things that matter in terms of my life and whether I feel safe or not. I think that growing up in Toronto, I think we forget, but it's important to be reminded that a lot of the people who started BLM, especially in Toronto, are of queer experience. And sometimes that piece gets left out of the conversation. And, you know, even for me, I guess being a person of color, I find that I am sometimes, I guess, when we're just talking about Blackness or Black lives, that I'm not going to be 100% accepted by even Black people. And so sometimes the conversation around Black Lives Matter makes me feel like, well, yes, I'm all for that. And it's really important we're talking about that. But it's also important we talk about trans lives. It's also important we talk about queer lives, women, intersectionality in this conversation, because, you know, there's a reason, for instance, I don't go to Caravana, right? Or things like that. It's like, I know that if I'm outed or because I pass, when people find out I'm trans, will it still matter, or will my safety still be respected? And so I guess to kind of wrap up this answer, I was even watching some of the press stuff around what was going on at Ryerson. And it was really incredible for me to see a lot of the people speaking are members of the community that I know, of the queer Black community. And it was that extra reminder to me that, okay, cool, we're here, that these people are part of the conversation, that if anything, they're leading the conversation. And yet at the same time, I'll read an Instagram thread or something, usually, you know, it from the US, where obviously we'll get into all the stuff that's going on there, I'm sure. But they'll say something like, why does LGBT need to be part of this conversation? Or why does the LGBT movement have to always co-opt things that are supposed to be just about this or just about that? And I would love, I'm excited to hear everyone's thoughts on this, because it is a really interesting thing that's going on. So I guess to answer the question, I'm seeing it excluded, but I'm also seeing active inclusion and active conversations, and this panel included.
That makes sense to me. So you touched on a lot of things. The leaders of a lot of these movements, we can go all the way back to Stonewall. You have queer identifying people, you have trans people that are leading the movements. You have Black women doing Me Too and Say Her Name. And so what I want to get to the bottom of is, why then are those intersectional needs not necessarily showing up or understood or heard in wider society? Because I think, Luca, what you said is bang on. Raven, what do you think?
I think the issues with transphobia and erasure don't start from the Black community. They are a global issue, right? And because we are a part of the world, we are having to deal with and grapple with those issues. Mm-hmm. So when you think about trans folks in media throughout time, I remember the first time I saw a trans person on television on the Ricky Lake show, they were seen as liars, as deceivers, as people who were going to harm you, Hitchcock. Like, there are so many ways in which we have been taught that trans folks, non-binary folks, two-spirit folks are to be feared. But before colonization, as a Mohawk child, before colonization, there were 26 different ways to identify, to name a few, and that's just here in North America, right? And so we have been stuck with this binary that no one really fits into, if you really think about it. No one really fits into it. We all kind of are forced to try and get as close to that as possible, because what we're taught is in order to be respected, you have to be a white Christian man. And the further away you get from that, the less important you are, the less heard you are, the less valued your opinion or your life experiences are. And you're right. Black Lives Matter Toronto was started by Black, queer, and trans women, but so was the Black Lives Matter movement, period. Black Lives Matter was started by Black women, queer women, trans folks, who it started as a letter, right? A love letter to Black people after the no indictment charge of George Zimmerman, right? It was saying, Black people, you matter. Black people, we see you, and we're going to fight for you. And then we started to organize under that banner. So it was Black women, Black queer and trans women, who started this global movement, right? But because we've been taught that the only people who can lead are wearing suits like Martin Luther King, then that's all we kind of pay attention to. And so when you get further away from that, you get identities like mine, for example, folks don't really know what to do with that, because my mathematic equation isn't actually supposed to add up. Like, I'm not supposed to exist in the way that I do as a Black, trans, queer, two-spirit person, you know? But I think that in like the intersectionality that Black women have taught us, right? Like from the doctrine of Black women, is what we're being forced to reckon with right now. Even within the Black Lives Matter Toronto movement, we released a statement recently that said, you know, we have transphobia in our movement. We have allowed it for a really particular amount of time for the greater good, the better of the movement. Let's not address it. It's too tough. Mm-hmm. It's too difficult, you know. But that leaves people like me in really particular danger. And so we had to deal with it. We had to look at it. And then we're asking everyone to do that, to look at it, to deal with it. And so globally, there is a conversation within the Black Lives Matter movement around who is left out, who isn't at the table, who can we invite into the room to have these conversations about how we organize, how we strategize.
Okay, so something you said there, Raven, that really struck me is this whole idea of making it a little easier. And I think that already revolution is hard. And then if it's not in this beautiful package with a bow, i.e. Martin Luther King in a suit, it's, you know, there's this fear that it's not going to take hold. And I wonder how you get past that. And so for me, when I look at the, you know, the feminist movement of the 60s, 70s, it was a white women's movement. In order for white women to go to work, they hired women of color to come and watch their children, you know, not necessarily with a lot of rights, not necessarily with a lot of pay. And it felt like the idea is, let us get this, and then if we remember, we'll work on you all. Can a movement work like that, Cicely? Can we have, you know, let's get the Black men squared off, and then we're the Black cisgendered hetero men squared off, and then we'll work on everyone else?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think it can work that way. I think that's the perception we have, because I think the way that our society functions is we think that we have to approach things in binaries. Like, everything about the functioning of our society is in a binary. And so it's really, really difficult for people to imagine that folks are experiencing multiple systems of oppression simultaneously. Like, that's hard for people to get their heads around. And I think especially before we even get to talking about the revolution, before we even get to talking about like activism, which I think up until this moment has really been sidelined and has been seen as, you know, this radical, like, unapproachable thing. But even in my work as a workplace consultant, I still see exactly the same issues of, oh, you know, we're doing our anti-racist initiative, or we're doing our LGBTQ inclusion initiative, but there's never any overlap. And that there's never any recognition of people who are living at the intersections of those identities. And so therefore those people are being like systemically left out and systemically isolated from movements which are inherently for good, but are without that intersectional lens are certainly missing. And I think especially to kind of like flip it the other way, when we think about the LGBTQ rights movement, you know, especially here in Canada, yes, progress has been made. And while some members of the community have reached certain levels of privilege that maybe they weren't afforded 50, 60 years ago, so many others are still being left behind. And I think there's also this issue of, that's what power does to folks. It's, you know, once you're able to access privilege and access power and access safety, you've made it, as it were. You're now accessing society, kind of what Raven was saying, in the same way as white Christian men. As soon as you and your community reach that level, it's very hard to turn around and, you know, stop the bus and say, actually, we left some people behind. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing.
Interesting, Cicely. Yeah, that's a good way to lay it out there. I wanted to spend some time talking about the whole rationalization of pain and Black women. There are a lot of tropes out there that certainly a wider audience, they might think these certain things about Black women and they might not know why. And so that's why I wanted to discuss three of the major ones. The stereotype of Jezebel, the hypersexual, promiscuous Black woman, it helped to justify rape during slavery. And rape, of course, was an economic tool because you could breed more human property. What is the impact of that stereotype on Black women now? Who feels comfortable answering that?
Oh, I can start.
Raven, go for it.
As a burlesque performer, who, like, I dig into the history of the liberation of Black women and women of color who have used comedy, satire, illusion, and glamour to talk about who we are, what we want, what we deserve, what consent is, what it isn't, to really take our place in society, you know. Like, being a burlesque performer was some of the first ways that women were able to work, where we were able to earn their own money, their own fame. And so the body has always been something that is hyper-consumed. And due to that hyper-consumption and the ingenuity of Black people in general, Black women have had to utilize it to navigate, to move through the world. The issue when people are talking about the Jezebel character, for example, is that when you are sexually confident, you are assumed to be unmoral, right? We're really talking about morality. We're really talking about, like, the ideals of what people are supposed to be, but Black women were unwomaned. Right? You can't treat people that way without actually erasing their humanity. And so because our humanity was erased, we've had to build it in all these really particular ways. And so having those tropes exist is harmful, but a lot of folks have utilized that to move through the world and to expand. I think about Sarah Bartman, who the South African woman who I think was one of the first people, Black people, African people, that white folks saw. And like for people in South Africa, she didn't look different, but over here, she looked really different. And so to the point where when she died, they cut up her body and put it in a museum. Mm. Right, like this is what we're dealing with, which is why trans bodies are dissected. It comes like from a really particular root. right? When you're dissecting, well, how is this different? What does this look like? What can I do with this? We're basically like science projects. And so we've been working really hard to like take hold of the narrative, reclaim our bodies and our sensuality and sexuality as promiscuous women, as sexual women, as sex workers. All those things are important and actually help us understand ourselves in massively important ways.
And we're allowed to be all those things, right? We're allowed to exist outside of these tropes.
Absolutely.
Sapphire is a big one. A domineering woman who consumes men and usurps their role. She's masculine. She's aggressive. She's the angry Black woman. She doesn't have any feelings. You can take her children away from her on the auction block during slavery, separate her from her children. You can beat her. She is devoid of emotion. What is the impact of this stereotype on Black women now? Do you want to take that?
Yeah, totally. These tropes that have been created around Black women and Black femininity, I think, you know, as Raven was saying, they're not new. Like they have such a depth and such a painful and violent history in it. And I think sometimes when people, you know, use microaggressions or play into stereotypes, we're expected to sort of just, you know, let it slide off our backs. Or, you know, people are like, oh, you don't have to play into the stereotype, or you don't have to be impacted by it. But actually what you're doing is making a comparison to a time when Black people were literally property, were commodities, were sold and bought and violated in so many different ways. So first off, yeah, I think it's really important for us to remember the weight of those things. And I think especially this angry Black woman narrative, I think we can't dismiss the fact that that narrative also doesn't exist if it's not made in contrast to the perception of white women and the perception of white women as innocent and weak, but not necessarily in a negative way, and vulnerable and soft. And I think sometimes in allyship work, I think white women also have to be cognizant of that portrayal and how them sort of, you know, I think we talked before, thinking a lot about Amy Cooper, the person who called the cops on a Black man walking his dog or threatened to call the cops in Central Park, and how she was specifically playing into this narrative that she knew she would be perceived as the victim. And I think that exacerbates that contrast for Black women and sort of exacerbates how Black women, when they access any space, and I would say especially healthcare, are not given the care, the treatment, the respect they deserve because they are perceived as thick skin, literally, literally perceived as feeling less pain, as being less impacted, less bothered by something. And you know, can have very detrimental impacts, you know, to the point where we see statistics like Black women being 3 times more likely to die during childbirth. And that comes directly from that statistic. And just, again, what Raven was saying about Sarah Bartman, that's one of the most fascinating stories from history for me, because I think it also highlights the contrast and like, the weird dichotomy of both violating Black women and perpetuating harmful stereotypes about Black women, but simultaneously Black women sort of being, everybody wants to be Black, but nobody wants to be Black, you know, like that kind of narrative of, Sarah Bartman was paraded around, and because of the size and shape of her body, it actually, quote unquote, inspired the creation of the bustle dress, like during the Victorian times. And we see that time and time again into the present day, what is vilified on Black people, especially Black women, is then applauded on white women. You know, it's cool if Kylie Jenner has cornrows, but it's ratchet or it's unprofessional if a Black woman has them or a Black femme. So yeah, there's so many layers to this, and it's not just about the stereotype itself. It's about the double standards, and it's about the dichotomy of Black women and white women.
The impact is so huge and so far reaching that it's almost mind boggling. Luca, you're in a unique situation in the sense that you've experienced life as both a Black woman and a Black man, and you're comfortable speaking about that. How did you feel moving through the world as a Black woman, and how did this change as you transitioned to a Black man?
Good question. So many, I just want to say incredible things just said right here. You know, it changed in me in so many ways that I could hardly even touch on the nuances of it in this conversation. But just listening to both of you right now, it reminded me, you know, I spent the first 20 years of my life Black female, you know, female POC. And then the last 10 years of my life, I've been male, and not just male identified, but passing as male. I'd say that the transition between being seen as female, Black female, and how I'm treated now was probably the hardest part of the entire transition for me, more than any medical, more than family, just because, and I guess what it really was is the realization that the intersection of racism and sexism are so prevalent in our society, that when I was, you know, living my life as female, I was very insular almost. I was like scared even to be myself, to wear anything other than male clothes. I mean, obviously I felt like a guy, so I wanted to be more masculine, but I was almost like afraid of myself, I guess, in a sense. And when I transitioned to male, I had a whole other set of new fears. And the way in which I was perceived, I mean, two examples that directly tie into what both of you were saying is at my job, I had my first job as male. I worked actually in tech. How much more seriously they treated me and how much more respect I was given compared to when I was a female identified person was, you know, just night and day situation, almost emotionally taxing because, again, you start to realize, wow, people really don't see Black women a lot of the time as even being to be taken seriously, even like, or that their opinions are not as important. And just, you made that comparison to white women or whiteness or the hierarchy of privilege. It's like, when I started to really pass as a man, the privilege was a lot of those things that used to really bother me about how I was treated did go away. However, they were replaced by a lot of other understandings. Like now I was seen as a little bit more of a threat. I'm a little bit more when I'm walking on the street. And one time I was walking on Queen Street. I lived around there. It was nighttime. There was a white couple in front of me. I was walking around trying to look for a place to eat. And the man turned around and asked me if I'd go in front of them. Basically, you're scaring my girlfriend because you're walking too close to us. Can you pass us? And I said, I don't like getting into, you know, fights necessarily. I was just like, sure, sounds good. But it was those subtle moments throughout the last 10 years. I'm used to them now. And I just, this is my life. But it's been an interesting experience, to say the least.
Okay. Very interesting. Any of this ring true for you, Raven? Any of these experiences ring true for you? Just moving through the world?
Yeah. I mean, I think it, like, starting from the beginning, right? Like, generally speaking, I wasn't raised this way, but generally speaking, men are raised to dream as big as they possibly can. Their dreams can't be big enough. But young girls are taught to have their dreams fit inside someone else's. And so right from that place, you're taught to compromise, to small yourself. You mentioned feeling afraid and having to be insular. For me, it's a little different because I don't pass. And I probably will never, because that's not an intention of mine. But I'm a dancer professionally. So when I was perceived as male, there was a particular way that my body and my experience was privileged, right? There's particular roles that I was able to get, particular rooms that I was able to be allowed in, schools, programs, because I fit a narrative of Blackness, of male Blackness, that was comfortable for folks to see on stage. However, when I started to ask questions of like, hey, I don't feel comfortable being just my chest out in front of everyone. Can I have something that covers it? No one understood it. No one gave me space to have concerns and discomfort with my own physicality, because it was seen as something that was praised. And so there wasn't enough space for me to be expansive in masculinity and now expansive in femininity. I have the other side of it, but the same problem. In terms of, I was speaking at a press conference just the other day, and there were comments like, we went from Martin Luther King to this. And so for me, it's like there's this frustration that I have about prettiness. We talked about like the Jezebel, the sapphire, and how pretty people get attention, right? Like it's the world we sort of live in and have been taught to accept. And so if I am not someone you're attracted to, then there's a particular way you're not going to listen to me. Or if you're really attracted to me, there's a particular way you're not going to listen to me. So, you know, you end up sitting in this place where you're exotified for who you are, but not respected for who you are. People are attracted to you, but don't want to date you. So many of my Black trans sisters have been murdered from just going on dates, you know, doing a thing that people should be allowed to do without the fear that they're not going to be going home to their loved ones, right? And so these are really deep rooted problems, and it's related to white supremacy. Like the furthest thing away from a white Christian man is a Black trans woman, you know what I mean? And so people are sort of agents of the state without realizing it. And what I mean by that is people think they're doing the right thing by saying that I'm an abomination. They think that that is the role that they're supposed to play in letting me know that my existence isn't supposed to be a thing, blasphemous, all that kind of stuff that we learned from one God, you know, as opposed to all the gods that everyone praises to. We're not learning lessons from all of them. We are taught to focus and speak with the language of one. And so for me, that's sort of the breakdown in my experience in general.
Yeah, very well explained. Thank you for that. Luca, I noticed you. Did you want to jump in?
I was going to say that, everything that you said, I guess I was going to add on that as once I started to be perceived in this way, I want to basically say that everything you said, Raven, was just 100% on from also my experience hearing it from the outside. And I find that in my position and in the way my transness interacts with the world, it took me years, you know, ashamed or not to admit this, but to even know how to stand up to some of that talk and some of that language and be able to support more trans identities and more people who were trans or even not trans. But when you're a guy, I guess, and you can probably comment on this too, but people are saying all kinds of stuff to you. Mm-hmm. Sexist stuff, racist stuff, homophobic stuff, transphobic stuff. They just assume that you're going to agree just because you're this Black guy. Therefore, you're going to agree. You're some, like a visible trans woman might walk into the room and they're saying all this stuff to me about it, about how they don't like it or how they think it's weird. And little do they know, they're friends with a trans person, you know, sometimes years before I came out more publicly like this, right? So I just want to say everything you said really resonated with me, and just great explanation all around.
Mm-hmm. Cicely, you said something interesting in your pre-interview, and that's that Black activists are fighting for everyone, but it doesn't always seem like everyone is fighting for us. What can the feminist movement, what can the LGBTQ2+ movement do better?
I think listening to Black people, listening to Black women and Black trans women who, yeah, I really do believe that, you know, I think exactly as Raven said, there is unfortunately a hierarchy that exists in our society. And so those who have been placed at the bottom by white supremacy and by these power structures, if those folks get free, then we all get free. Like, I think that's really how it should work. And, you know, those who are most impacted by a whole intersection of, you know, racism, homophobia, transphobia, in my work and in my personal identity, I'm fighting racism, I'm fighting anti-Blackness, I'm fighting sexism, homophobia, transphobia. Whereas, like, a white cis woman, for example, is only fighting sexism. So folks whose lived experience, and I think that is changing in some ways, where we're recognizing that, you know, lived experience is a form of knowledge and is a form of valuable knowledge. Like, I think, well, yeah, I think it there's still work to do, but we sort of come from a standpoint where we think it's all about credentials and it's all about, you know, how many academic papers have you published? And I think for a long time, feminism was really about that. Like, you know, it was kind of like the Judith Butler type of feminism of like, you know, have you written about it? Have you coined a new term? And I think we're slowly moving to understand that lived experience of oppression is probably the most valuable type of knowledge that we have. So I really think it's crucial for movements to be coming together and honoring and acknowledging one another. And I think that will result in the liberation of everyone. I do think like one thing that always comes to my mind is I can never forget the Pulse nightclub shooting, for example, which happened a few years ago. And it was kind of from the outside seen as a crime against the LGBTQ community. But then when you actually look at the folks who were victims of that and who passed away in that incident, the majority of them were Black and Latinx queer folks, queer and trans folks. But that was never really kind of highlighted. That was never centralized in the conversation. And I remember going to a vigil after that event here in Vancouver, and there was no talk of race. There was no conversation about the intersectionality of these people's experiences. It was sort of co-opted into a larger movement. And for me, that was really alarming because I didn't feel like a lot of those folks, especially cisgender, gay, white men who, for the most part, especially here in Vancouver, are living reasonably, you know, privileged and advantaged lives, really truly understood the experiences of the queer and trans people of color who'd passed away in that incident. And that was just for me like a really profound reminder of why we need to be focusing on intersectionality and be listening to the voices of folks in the movement. And kind of going back to what you were saying at the beginning around, you know, is this movement, is what's currently happening now really honoring Black women's voices and Black queer and trans voices? I think at the core of it, kind of as was discussed, many BLM chapters and BLM as an organization was founded by Black queer women and LGBTQ folks. But as the movement sort of disseminates into mainstream media, that narrative gets lost and it kind of gets diluted. And we, as you say, run the risk of whitewashing or diluting a movement like what happened with Pride. So I think it's just really so important to hold on to those, origins and hold on to those narratives. And I think that's the best way forward.
Cicely, I loved your TED talk where you talked about going to university and really finding a Black community. But then when you showed them, you know, embraced all the sides of yourself and your queer identifying side, they did not accept you. Do you find that there's been evolution in that?
Yes, I do think so. I think, whenever I talk about those things, and I mention it in the TED talk as well, I'm always like nervous that people inherently perceive Black communities to be more homophobic or transphobic than others. And as I was researching for the TED talk, I did discover this really interesting research that kind of shows there is no more homophobia or transphobia in one community to the next. I think it's part of white supremacy that's like villainizing Black communities and saying like, oh, they're so, you know, backwards, they're so uncivilized, they don't accept like progressive modern things like queer and transness. That's absolutely not the case at all. But yes, in my experience, when I tried to enter into communities that didn't value intersectionality in the core of what they did, so it was a group that solely focused around Black identity. There wasn't any space or any leeway for Black folks who were queer and trans. And then when I tried to enter the Pride Club, it solely focused on LGBTQ identity and there was no anti-racism element. So there was no, there was no support or infrastructure or representation for Black queer and trans folks there. So you're kind of left in this weird space where to choose a space means sacrificing part of who you are. And that's for me why BLM became such a pivotal part of my identity and part of my my growth as a person, because it was the only space I could find that valued both elements, all elements of who I am. And I do think things are changing because I think especially like with younger generations, with like Gen Z. I mean, I think, you know, Gen Z are really cool. They don't care. They're just, you know, they're just showing up in spaces doing the most, which I think is amazing. And so I do see change there, which feels really good. And I hope that, you know, especially in an academic space on a university campus, it can be very isolating and difficult, especially for Black, queer and trans folks. So I do think there is change happening, which I think is great.
what needs to happen for the movement to move forward in an inclusive way? This is a big question. Luca, I'm going to throw it out to you. And then Raven, you can take a stab at it.
I agree with everything that was said. You know, I'll add on that, at least for me, we've seen so much change. You know, I transitioned 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I was so scared. People didn't even know what trans, like, I would tell people I was trans and they'd be like, what is that? You know, and so I think we've seen a lot of change in the last 10 years. On the other side, though, if we're talking about how to make it more inclusive and how do we get ultimately where we're going in this conversation, is there needs to be a better understanding that of these intersectionalities, that transness exists, that you can be Black and trans also, that queer people are also Black. Like, we know this in this room, but sometimes when I'm out in the world and I tell people that I'm trans, they're like shocked. Not just, I guess there's the shock because they don't think they've met a trans person maybe, or they don't think they have an idea of what a trans person looks like and maybe I don't fit that mold. But I think they're also shocked because I'm, you know, a person of color, and they're surprised that, you know, that could even be a thing. And so I think that if we're going to continue to move forward, we have to, like, I said this a long time ago, but I would love to live in a world where I told people that I was trans and they just said, that's, like, they were like, cool, you know, or we can have a conversation about it. And I'm sure there's questions, but I think the deep shock shows us that we're still not quite there. We're still not to a place where we have normalized any of this, or where we think that trans people look all different kinds of ways. And then on top of that, and I love what you said about the homophobia and being kind of prevalent everywhere, but we need to undo these deep-seated understandings about how people of color, how these two things relate, as I just said. And I was reached out to by a mother who had a trans son. She's of Jamaican descent. She's very accepting of her son, but she wanted some extra support. She thought he needed some extra support. So we had a very great and emotionally amazing conversation. And she said that she went to a support group for parents, and she went to the room and she told me that she felt like there was surprise that she was there. They almost wondered if she was in the right room. You know, like, how could you, are you sure you're in the right place? Like, you're a Black woman. Like, are you sure that you accept your trans kid, or do you even have a trans kid? So we have a lot of undoing to do deep down in all of us and as a society. But I do see I do see things moving in the right direction. I think these conversations are important. This is how we do it. And I think that changing sometimes even one opinion can be an incredible start.
Okay. And Raven?
I'm a firm believer in the fact that, like, you can't change outside what you're not working on inside, right? A lot of people are unhappy with who they are, with who they have to be in the world, with who they've, you know, some people aren't given a choice to be anything other than what they are. Some people are grow up in communities, countries, and understandings that force particular narratives. When you look at places like Jamaica, right, and it's seen as this highly homophobic, transphobic place, but then when you erase the history, so here is it. It's like people need to know the history of how these things came to be. Buggery laws, that was started by the Queen, like, Britain, the same person on the money here in Canada. Like, we're all connected to that, right? And so it's like the missionaries that went over to Jamaica and gave money to Jamaicans, to Black Jamaicans, to find gay folks, to burn them, right? Like, they were given money, incentive to people who were poor, who wanted to eat, who wanted to survive, who were like, yes, I will do this because it's for the greater good, like I mentioned earlier, and I'll be able to eat, right? And so there's this long history of that, this history of missionaries and slave masters raping men in front of their wives. And that is deep within our body, right? That's deep within our DNA. right? Those of us who are trans still have to work through transphobia. We still have to work through our own indoctrination into the system of whiteness, right? And the ways in which we are perpetuating some of the same things that we're trying to fight. And so that's sort of my understanding for myself. Like, for, I always speak from a personal standpoint of the things that I didn't really know. I was like, oh, I'm accessible. I allow everyone in space, but accessibility is constant. Being an ally is constant. It's a commitment. It's like a tattoo, right? Like, you are making a life choice that isn't just this moment in time. Like, if you want people to be free, it takes a long time to be free, to know that you are free, and then to live free. And so for trans folks and non-binary folks, you're seeing a surge in representation. You're seeing folks on television, folks in media, folks taking hold of their Instagram. I know Instagram and these things are seen as like these vapid holes of not a whole lot of substance. However, they are places where people are connecting, are finding their communities, are seeing themselves, are able to create a larger scope and expansion of our truth about what exists in the world, you know? The fat bodies, the skinny bodies, the bodies that are average and in between, the pretty girls, the girls who are beautiful, the ones who are stunning, the ones who want to be models, the ones who are anti that, like, everyone exists. And so if we make space for everyone to exist, then we won't have to fight in the same way that we do. You know, we're taught that Donald Trump, we're taught that power is the only way for us to get what we want. It's the only way for us to feel like we own something. You know, I can't just own myself. I have to own myself and another thing. That's learned behavior, right? So all of it has to be uprooted. All of the systems within ourselves. And it's hard stuff. I want to dance next to Janet Jackson. That would be really awesome, you know? But that also means that I have to participate in a system that I am actively trying to abolish. You know what I mean? If I'm trying to decentralize capitalism and decentralize, you know, organizing and economic disparity, then I also have to shift what my dreams are since I was a child, right? And it's hard work. It's not easy. It's difficult. I think that some folks are like, I already have to deal with so much. I work 70-hour weeks, and then I gotta figure out how to read this book on the history of Black folks. And it's like, what I say is, it isn't always Blackness that you need to teach yourself. You also need to teach yourself about all the ways in which, and this is for white folks, all the ways in which your ancestors, your elders, the people who you come from benefited from the disenfranchisement of other people, and the ways in which you yourself might continue to perpetuate that. You know, I think we have this thing we call privilege. Everyone has it. I have it in particular ways, and I don't have it in other ways. Everyone has a bit of it. But if we utilize what we have instead of being ashamed of it, or feeling guilty for it, if we utilize it so that other people have a piece, have more, which means we might have a little bit less, then we all get somewhere. You know, I said this thing, like, if I don't get to have my dream of dancing next to Janet Jackson, but what I'm doing saves a young Indigenous girl, then that's worth that dream, you know? And I don't know if everyone is willing to self-sacrifice in that way. But we come from, as African descendants, you know, we come from from abolitionists. They abolished slavery. That's where we come from, this root of being like, you know, we want to be free. We want to have our life. We want to have our own justice. We want to create our own community accountabilities and understandings so that we hold each other in love as opposed to carceral or punishment, right? These are all the sort of things that I think about in terms of moving and moving forward, thinking about inclusiveness, being an example, living through that example. And you're going to mess up and stuff, but being aware of everything in the world. I don't actually believe people when they say they didn't know that this was happening. I think that you have to be honest. Like, you have to be honest and be like, I didn't care. I was an immigrant and I didn't want to get in trouble. Like, just be honest so that we can deal with that. I don't think that it's the wrong thing to say, you know, I was prioritizing my safety and I wasn't thinking about y'all. then you're like, okay, I can understand that because I have done that too. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And then we have something that's in common. And so this is what I did with it. This is how I dealt with it. I'm not safe on a regular basis, but I put myself in front of a Black Lives Matter movement so that other trans women and girls can see themselves in front of a movement. It's not easy to be there, but I understand that I have the mechanisms in place to be able to do that. That is my privilege. And so, you know, that's how it works.
Raven Wang, Cicely Bell Blaine, Luca Rosenberg Lee, thank you, all three of you, for joining this conversation. It was nuanced. I learned, I hope our viewers learned as well. And of course, the video will stay up on CityLine's YouTube channel. Subscribe to CityLine's YouTube channel. I know that we've just done 5 episodes and we're going to take a little break, but we'll be back in the fall and we're going to open up this conversation and talk about all of the things. Because Raven, you mentioned so many of the things, Cicely and Luca, you too. There's so many things we can delve into that need to be worked on, and the work, it's a lifetime commitment to the work. So thank you so much, all three of you, for joining us today. And thank you for everyone who tuned into this episode and the entire series. Thank you for learning along with us.